Well, I want to welcome everyone here. We're going to try to go ahead and get started. Typically, if you're new to Academy, what we try to do, we start at 6:15, and I usually give you a couple minutes. I'll just say at 6:15, we got a couple minutes, and give you a chance to do one last thing you need to do before we get started, and then we get going by 6:17, 18 at the very latest. Tonight we had a lot of people, as some of you know, standing in the line. We didn't want to leave anyone out as we get started because there's some important things here up front to talk about. My name is Rick Taylor, and I'll be leading some of these sessions, and Jeff Doolittle is back here. Jeff, could you just stand up and wave to everyone? Yep, there's Jeff, and Jeff will be teaching a few of these classes as well, and I'm really excited. This is a specialty of his. And I'm looking forward to that. Let me pray, and we'll get started. Father, thank you so much that you have not just put us here and said, good luck, I hope you can figure it out. You've given us your word. You've given us a book that helps us to understand you, to understand ourselves, to understand the life that you've given us and that you desire for us to live. God, I thank you for your spirit that you've given to encourage us, to help us along the way in this journey of faith that we're all on. I pray that you would use your word, use your spirit in our lives, in our minds, in our hearts, in the weeks ahead, to help us understand the questions that many of us have and that many of our friends have about the Christian faith. God, I pray that you'd use this in a powerful way in each one of our lives. In Jesus' name, amen. Well, the tables are helpful, and so if you want a place at a table, it helps to get here early and everything, because you got stuff to write on and all that. But if you're sitting on a chair without a table, if you can, you might just want to pull out your notes for that day and write on your notebook on your lap. That's helpful as well. This particular semester, we're going to be talking about answering the most often asked questions about Christianity. And there are 12 specific questions that we're going to be looking at. There are 14 weeks in this semester, so I just want to tell you, the last 12 of those, starting 2 weeks from tonight, we will start with those 12 questions and work through. Tonight and next week, we're going to be doing some prep work for that, because it's not helpful just to give people answers. If that was all that was needed, we could just give them a piece of paper and say, here, read this. It'll answer your question. But people ask us as a person, and they're coming from some place, and they have some ideas in mind that have led them to believe certain things or that have led to confusion about certain things in their minds about Christianity that's causing them to ask questions. And understanding where they're coming from and understanding them a little bit better is just as important as having an answer to give them. So we're going to talk about both of those this semester. Every week we're going to, starting in 2 weeks, every week we're going to start our class with a brief interaction for just a few minutes around a true story that you will read for your homework that week. Be about 2 to 4 pages long. It's pretty simple, pretty intriguing stories. They're all true, all real life. I know the individuals involved in them. And you're going to read those, and you'll interact about them a little bit and see how they got into a discussion about this. So we're talking about how we share, not just what we share, in terms of responding to people's questions this semester. For me personally, I really enjoy this semester because there was a period of my life when I devoted full time to just doing this, not teaching a class, but meeting in homes with 30, 40 people there, and all they would do was ask questions, and I never answered any of them. What I did was force them to think through things. So when someone would ask a question, I would say, well, what does someone think? And they would start sharing their ideas on that, and I'd say, that's interesting. And I would start taking their answers out on the limb, Well, let's take that out to its natural consequences, to its natural conclusion. And they'd say, well, I really don't like that. Well, then maybe you need to rethink your answer. Somebody else have an answer? And we would respond, or I'd say, what do you think about what Joe said over here? And we would just interact. I never shared a thing, but I saw people come together, as Isaiah said, come let us reason together. Let's think about these important things together. And I loved it. I loved it. And I have to tell you, I cannot remember in all the years that I did that, week after week, having those kind of discussions all over the country in many ways, I can never remember there being a time when one of these weren't the questions at the root of what was being asked, these 12 questions. So that's why I've picked these 12 questions. Are there other questions that you may have or that friends may ask you? Yes. There very well could be, but these are at the heart of almost all the questions, ultimately, that people are asking about Christianity. Now, we're going to be looking at these 12 questions as it relates to Christianity. There will be people who will ask you things like, that we won't cover this semester, like, well, how does what you believe different from what this group of people believes? And we could have gone that direction, but we chose not to. We're taking the questions themselves and looking at them. What I would recommend are a couple of things. First of all, for this particular class, I would recommend everybody on the little sheets of paper that are on your table or hopefully around you, but I'll just read them in case you don't have them. This particular book, for your assignments week to week, there will be assignments in there a chapter a week out of this book. And they're not very long chapters. They're not hard to read. But that is something that is optional for you, but I would highly recommend I'm Glad You Asked by Larry Moody and Ken Boa. And they will follow along or will follow along right with where they're going chapter by chapter each week. For next week, your assignment would be the first two chapters. That sounds like, wow, you just said one chapter. We're talking about 10 pages, okay? And they're small pages. So wide margins, large letters, you can handle it. But it really will be helpful along the way. Yes? You can buy it locally. If not, you can go on Amazon. You might not get it. I understand. And if that's the case, you'll just be 10 pages behind. And you'll have 10 more pages the next week. I don't know what else to do on that. I could have charged more for the class and provided them for everyone, but some of you may have it, and some of you may not choose to get it. So I choose to leave that up to you. There is another book. If people ask you what you believe compared to what other people believe in different faiths, what some might call cults or religions or the occult or whatever, there's another book on there that I recommend highly. We're not going to cover it in this class. It's one of the best succinct books I've ever seen on this particular subject. It's Cults, World Religions, and the Occult by Ken Boa, one of the same authors for the other book I just recommended. It is an excellent resource. And one of the reasons I recommend that particular book is because he is very fair. He will go through and explain what it believes by quoting their primary sources rather than secondary sources or what other people say about what they believe. He'll quote from their religious documents and to build a picture of what they believe. And at the end of the chapter, he'll say, here are some things that I think are consistent with what Christianity teaches, and here are places where I think it's inconsistent. So he's just not badgering and putting down everything all the time. He's very fair in the way he approaches it, very open-minded and very succinct, and he does a good job of helping you understand different world religions, different cultic groups, different occult groups as well. So Cults, World Religions, and the Occult by Ken Boa is another book I'd recommend that runs, doesn't cover what we cover in this course, but he covers some of those other kinds of questions you might have. Now, if you'll look in your notebook, the very first page is a colorful page that has all of these different topics on it. And those are the ones that we're going to be covering in that order this semester. And if you'll turn the page then to the next page, you'll see a schedule for the semester. The date on the left-hand side corresponds with the focus of the class for that night. So tonight we're doing orientation and concepts of God and man, and the assignment for next week is chapters 1 and 2 and one handout that's in your notebook that I'll talk about in a few minutes. What we'll cover on January 28th will be a review briefly of the concepts of God and man and how they relate to concepts of ethics, values, and time. I'll explain more of that tonight. And your assignment then for the next week will be chapter 3. Make sense? And the assignment, when it says chapter whatever, it's out of this book. I'm glad you asked. Again, that's optional. If you want to read that, you can. It would be helpful to you, but it is not necessary. This is a class that's designed for you to get as much out of it as you want, and the more you put into it, the more you'll get out of it. I'm trying to give you some ideas of things you can do that would help you to get the most out of the class.
Are you saying chapters 1 and 2 is from that little book or the big Bible?
This little book. So when I say chapters 1 and 2, it's out of this book. I'm glad you asked. And the next week when it says chapter 3, it's out of this book. Okay? And then there are some handouts in the workbook. I'll show you that in just a second, how to do that. Any questions about that? Any further questions about that? That's just your assignment sheet, so you know where we're at. There is a spring break week in there, so pay attention to that. We'll try to remind you of that as we get closer, but there is one week in there for spring break. Okay, on the next page, it has a thing that says class description, homework, and then a passage. Another title we could have given for this class in the class description is Everything Your Friends Are Asking About Christianity and You Were Afraid They Were Going to Ask You. That could have been the title, but we're just talking about it in terms of answering that. We need to realize as we start off that the people who are asking questions about what you believe, they're looking for something. First of all, they're showing you respect and they're showing you that they care about what you have to think about that particular question. So we need to treat them with respect. We should be careful about people who believe differently than we do, who are asking us questions about what we believe, not to treat them like the enemy. They're not the enemy. They're people that Jesus Christ died for. He cared about them that much. And they're showing you enough respect to ask you what you think about something. So keep that in mind, but that's where we're going. We're going to be talking again about information, what we can say to them, but we're also going to talk about demeanor, how we can respond to them. And part of that depends on where they're coming from, and we'll start getting into that tonight. Your homework has three parts to it, and you can choose how much you choose to do. Every week, starting in 2 weeks, there will be that 2 to 4 page true story. So if you will turn to the tab that says, Is There a God? It should be the third tab in your notebook there. Not the third page where you're at, but the third tab. If you open it up, there is a story there. How do you know God really exists? Or something along those lines, something close to that. And there's a 3-page story that I would like you to read in preparation for that class. Now, that's in 2 weeks, not next week, but to read that. That would be what we're talking about there when we talk about read the 2 to 4 page true story. And again, those are true stories. These are actual encounters. The names have been changed, but other than that, they're pretty much word for word for the way the interactions took place. Then the second thing is to read the chapter that is referred to in here. So it'll be chapter 1 and 2 next week, or three the next week, etc. And I'm glad you ask if you choose to do that. And the last thing is other handouts, it says there, that you might have. So when I get to the end of the class tonight, I'll show you a handout at the end of tonight that I would like you to read for next week. So there's just that one handout that I wrote a long time ago in the Dark Ages that I'd like you to read that I think might be helpful to you. It'll sort of give you a summary and some illustrations of what we're covering tonight and next week. It'll give you some of that feel for it in case that's helpful to you. Then I have there a passage, 1 Peter 3, 15 to 16. Really, let me just focus on verse 15 for a second. It's sort of the theme verse for this entire semester. And this is from the Amplified Version. It says, "But in your hearts set Christ apart as holy and acknowledge him as Lord. Always be ready to give a logical defense to anyone who asks you to account for the hope that is in you, but do it courteously and respectfully." Did you notice the two things he says there in big picture form? He says, always respond to people. Always be ready to give a logical defense. Always, continually, perpetually, at any time, whether you're at school or at work or in Starbucks or someplace else, be prepared. Always be prepared. Be alert. Be ready, he says there. Be fit. It's a term that has to do with being in shape for whatever may come up, for any obstacle course or anything you might have to do physically, anything that comes along. It says be fit for that. Be ready for that. Be prepared. The old Boy Scout motto, be prepared for it whenever it comes to you. And he says to give a logical defense, a reasonable response to the hope that is in you. Be prepared to give a reasonable, logical response to the faith that you have. Be able to give that response. But then he adds these qualifiers. He says, but do it courteously and respectfully. We need to be thoughtful of them. We need to be courteous. We need to be respectful of the other person. He speaks here about be prepared to give them information that explains what you believe, and be prepared to do it in such a way that it's easy for them to receive, that they see that you care about them, you respect them. So this really just a theme verse for this entire semester, to not just give them information. Don't use information like a sledgehammer that you beat them over the head with it. This is what I believe, this is what you ought to believe, or else. And I don't know about you, but I've had people do that with me in the past. And I'm not very receptive. I don't care what they believe because I can't get past how they've responded to me. And there have been other people who have been very courteous and respectful, but don't have a thing to say. And they never get back with me, and they just sort of run from the situation. Neither one of those are helpful. He says, have the information. Have it at your disposal and give that information to them in a way that's courteous and respectful of who they are as a person that Jesus loved and died for. So that's a verse that we're going to be looking at, and then we will try to help you, help all of us grow in that. I've been teaching this a long time. I'm not an expert on anything. I'm a student of a lot of things, and what I share with you is where I'm at in my studies. There are a lot of things I don't know. There are many more things that I don't know than I do know. Hopefully, I can share some things just because I've been given the privilege and opportunity of time spent on these kinds of things. Maybe it'll be helpful to you this semester as well. The next page in your notebook, the fourth page, I believe it is, it says, regarding the use of this material, and then we're going to move on. But regarding the use of this material, basically what that says is that there are a lot of materials in this notebook that were written by me or a gentleman named Bill Parkinson. Bill Parkinson. Any of those materials are things that you can copy and share with anyone. But there are other materials in here that on the last page, the footnote, will have that it's written by somebody else. And those are things that we cannot share beyond this class. We have permission to use them because this is a class. And the laws allow us to copy a limited portion of other people's materials and use them in a classroom setting, which is what we're doing. But those cannot be given out to other people. They can't be mimeographed or copied or whatever you might want to do, scanned and passed on. Those documents can't be passed on to anyone else. Some of you are laughing because mimeographs are long gone. But anyway, some of you don't even know what it is. But anyway, that's what that's saying. I would ask that anything that you pass on to someone else, ask them not to mass produce and sell any of that, because that's illegal. So I would just encourage you to have them do. But if somebody wants something that you have in your notebook that either Bill Parkinson or Rick Taylor has written, feel free to copy it and give it to them. That's fine. Okay, enough of all that stuff. Now, let's get into some meat of the thing here. And on the next page, the next tab, really, in your notes there, it says concepts of God and man at the top. And we want to talk about those. Some of you were in a class that we did the very first year that we did this academy. So 3 years ago, you would have been in this class. And we talked about developing a biblical worldview, which we'll teach again next year. We're finishing the cycle, the three-year cycle this year, and we just pick up and keep going next year. But we talked a little bit about some concepts of God in that particular class, and we're going to talk about those again, but I want to do it from a little bit different vantage point tonight, and I want to tell you why we're not talking about how to respond to people and talk to them, whether they're Christians or Buddhists or Muslim or whatever they may be. Why we're going to talk about this from a different vantage point, a bigger picture. And the reason for that is, if somebody comes up to me and says, I'm a Christian, you know what that tells me about them? Almost nothing. It doesn't. I mentioned there in that top paragraph, it could mean one of at least six things. It could mean I was born in America and I'm not a Buddhist or a Muslim. It could mean I attend or belong to a church. It could mean I'm a good person, generally speaking. It could mean I'm not Islamic or I'm anti-Islamic if you live in another part of the world particularly. It could mean I believe in God. It could mean I have accepted Jesus' gift of forgiveness and a new life and I'm being transformed by his indwelling spirit. It could mean a lot of those things. I know that for me personally, there was a long time in my early life when if you had asked me, are you a Christian, I would have said yes. But if you asked me what made me a Christian, I would have told you I was born in America. I wasn't some other religion, whatever it may be. I went to church regularly. I would have told you a bunch of those kinds of things, none of which by themselves made me a Christian. But I would have claimed to be that. I was having a discussion. I was asked at a university when I was teaching there a few years ago, to present the difference between Christian counseling and secular counseling. And to do that, I had to share the gospel, and I did that out of the Gospel of John. I said, this is how the Bible defines Christian. And at the end of that, it was open to the faculty for question and answer. And one of the faculty members said, you mean you're telling me I've got to believe Jesus was a real person to be a Christian? He said, I've been an elder in my church for 20 years. I don't believe Jesus was real. Now, if you'd asked that man, are you a Christian? He would have loud and clear said, absolutely. But it didn't help me know where he was coming from. What he did say helped me understand where he was coming from. So what we want to do in this course is find out where are people coming from, not what labels do they give themselves. Okay? Because there will be people from all different faiths or religions, different parts of the Christian faith. And they'll say, well, I'm this, or I'm a Methodist, or I'm a Presbyterian, or I'm a whatever. I want to know, what do you believe? What's at the core of your belief system? Not what label do you give yourself? Because the label doesn't really help me that much. So when we talk about these concepts of God and man this week, and then we'll touch on them again next week and talk about how that impacts the way we look at life and make decisions, so that we can understand where people are coming from. Because every friend and neighbor that we have has some concept of God. And they have some concept of who I am as a person, who I am, who we are as people. And those are very significant. And there are key things we can do to find out what do they believe about God and about man. And when I begin to understand those things just a little bit, a few key questions or things to listen for in a discussion, I can begin picking up on their whole picture of things so that when they ask me a question about faith, I know where they're coming from better. Does that make sense? So we're going to spend a little bit of time this week and next week dealing with these big concepts of God and man. So there are two theses I want to make here, two things that are very important that I'm building this on. Thesis number one there on that first page in your concepts of God and man. Thesis number one is this: both through general and specific revelation, God has revealed himself to all mankind, and therefore every person has some, though probably distorted, concept of God. Now I want to look at some passages, but the thesis is saying this: God has revealed himself in a variety of ways to every person. Another way of saying this is everybody knows to one degree or another that God exists. Now that's important for me to know. I can remember sitting and talking with faculty members, with students, with friends that I had met, who would sit there and tell me they did not believe that God exists. And I would listen to them courteously and respectfully, but I didn't believe a word they were saying. That's interesting. And it would lead to questions that I would be able to ask them. One of the things we're going to see when we get to the whole question of how do you know that God exists, it's very, very simple. If a person is reasonable or logical at all, it's very simple to turn someone from being an atheist who says there is no God to moving them to becoming an agnostic that says, I don't believe you can know if there is a God. And it's very easy to move them from there to the next. Well, maybe there is a God that can be discovered, that can be found out. And we'll talk about that. And Jeff will lead us in that and answer all your questions about that in a couple of weeks. But that's a very simple thing to do. By the way, I'm glad you asked. This particular book walks you through that in detail as well, how we can do that, how we can help a person by just asking a few simple questions, how we can move them along in their belief system a little bit. So let's look at some passages to support this first thesis that God has revealed himself to every person. Look at Psalm 19 there. Let's look at the first four verses. The heavens declare the glory of God, and the firmament shows and proclaims his handiwork. Day after day pours forth speech from the creation that he has made, and night after night shows forth knowledge. There is no speech nor spoken word. Their voice is not heard, yet their voice goes out. It shouts out through all the earth their sayings to the end of the world. Of the heavens, God has made a tent for the sun. And he goes on. He's saying God has, in his general revelation, he has revealed himself in his creation. When I go look at a piece of art, I can look at that and I can say, I wonder what that is. And there are some pieces of art, I look at it a long time and ask, I wonder what it is. But you know, whatever it is, as I study it, I learn something about the artist. God has created the universe, and this universe is his palette. And as we study the universe, we can learn certain things about the artist, the one who painted on that palette the universe. We can learn certain things about him. He has revealed himself in that sense. He says, you cannot sit down and look at the night sky and see the stars spread throughout. He said, it's as if those stars were shouting to us, how did we get here? There's got to be something that explains how we got here. And there is nothing in natural science to explain it. We can talk about the Big Bang Theory. It all banged into existence out of infinite density at some point in time. Where did that infinite density come from? And scientists who are honest will say that you go back in science and there is a point in time when you have to say science can no longer be the explanation. It's got to be something else. There's got to be something else. The heavens are shouting to us this. Look at verse 7. He goes even beyond that. He says in verse 7, the law of the Lord is perfect, restoring the person. The testimony of the Lord is sure, making wise the simple. The precepts of the Lord are right, rejoicing the heart. The commandment of the Lord is pure and bright, enlightening the eyes. The fear of the Lord is clean, enduring forever. The ordinances of the Lord are true and righteous altogether. And he talks about God has not only revealed himself in his heavens, in his creation, he has revealed himself in his word, in a written document. He refers to it as here as the law, testimony, the precepts, the commandments, the ordinances. He's making reference to God has in written form given us explanation of who he is, what he's like, who we are, what we're like, how he designed life to be lived. He's revealed himself in creation. He's revealed himself in his word. He has done both of those things. And they're available to all people, especially the general creation of the heavens. Look at the next one, thesis number 2. Every person's concept of an ultimate cause or causer is determinative in their self-concept and the resultant concept of mankind in general. I don't know who wrote that, but it's really a lot of funny words all put together. Basically saying this, whatever my concept of God is, it has a reflection on what I think about myself, who I think I am. If I think that God is the sovereign ruler of the universe, then when I look at myself, it puts me in my place because I'm not the sovereign ruler of the universe. If I look at God and I say, I don't believe you exist, and therefore, who is God? Well, I can say, well, government is God. Government's what's ultimate. Or I can say, I'm what's ultimate. Then all of a sudden, I look at myself differently than if I had a different concept of God that says he's ultimate. Does that make sense? So whatever I believe about God, it says it has a transferable implication about some of the things I might think about myself. Now, this becomes important because if a person comes up to you and says, I don't believe there's a God, or says, I'm an atheist, then the question in my mind is, so what is or who is ultimate to you? That's what I want to know. That's what I want to find out. Because if I can find that out, then it helps me understand what they think about themselves. Maybe they think they are God. They're the ultimate in the universe. They're not responsible to anyone. That's going to have a bearing on things we're going to look at next week in terms of their ethics. How do they determine right and wrong? Well, if I'm ultimate, then I determine what's right and wrong. You know, there's nothing wrong with cheating as long as you get away with it in that person's mind. Nothing at all. There is no right or wrong except what I determined what's right or wrong. Well, how do I determine what's right and wrong? Usually, what works for me? What helps me out? And so I'm beginning to learn something about this person by just asking a few questions, thinking about those things. We'll talk more about that. Look at Psalm 8, one of the Psalms of David. He says, O Lord, our Lord, how excellent is your name in all the earth. You have set your glory on the heavens. Out of the mouths of babes and unweaned infants, you have established strength because of your foes, that you might silence the enemy of the avenger. Then notice what he says. He's just talked about, O Lord, how Lord, how majestic, how excellent is your name in all the earth. Verse 3, when I view and consider your heavens, the work of your fingers, the moon and the stars, which you have ordained and established, what does that say about me? Verse 4, who am I? What is man that you are mindful of him? And the son of man that you care about him, that we human beings, who are we compared to you? Here the psalmist David says, when I look at you and who you are, it makes me wonder, who am I? Because I'm not you. I'm not capable like you. I don't do the things you do. And who am I that you would even care about me? It has an implication about me. When he sees God this way, it says something about me. Who am I? He goes on in verse 5. He says, yet you have made him, mankind, but a little lower than God. And you have crowned him with glory and honor. You have made him to have dominion over the works of your hands. You have put all things under his feet. Who am I? I'm not worthy, he says. When I look at you and who you are, and I look at me and I know the mess that's inside of me, who am I that you would even think about me? And yet he goes on in the next verse and he says, but you've made me a little lower than God. And that's all. And you've given me great responsibility. All of a sudden, he has value, he has worth, he has responsibility. Why? Because of his view of God. Because that's who God made him to be. So he sees himself in that light. Make sense? Okay, look down at Romans 1. Look at verse 19, and we'll go from there. For that which is known about God is evident to them and made plain in their inner consciousness because God has shown it to them. Going back to thesis number one, God has made himself known. What is known about God is evident to them and made it plain in their inner consciousness and in them. He's made it plain in them. He's not only revealed himself in his creation, like we saw in Psalm 19, what he has also done is revealed himself inside of every human being. God has revealed himself in our innermost being, he says. He goes on, verse 20. For ever since the creation of the world, his invisible nature and attributes, that is his eternal power and divinity, have been intelligible and clearly discernible in and through the things that he has made. That's his creation again. So that men are without excuse. There is no excuse because he has made it clear to them. But notice what he goes on and says. Because when they knew and recognized him as God, did they know he was God? Yes. Did they recognize him as God? Yes. How? In his creation and inside. They knew that. But, he goes on, he says, they did not honor or glorify him as God or give thanks to him. They looked at him, realized who he was, but they were not willing to give him the position that he deserved and to thank him for what he had given them. Just the opposite of what we just looked at back in Psalm 8 with David. Look at that. But he says, but instead they became futile and godless in their thinking, and their senseless minds were darkened. Claiming to be wise, they became fools. And by them, the glory and majesty and excellence of the immortal God were exchanged for and represented by images resembling mortal man and birds and beasts and reptiles. Now, who makes an idol? Who makes an idol? We do. Absolutely. Why do we make idols? Because we're rejecting him for who he is, for who he, we clearly know that he is. Let me ask you this. Who is greater, the idol or the one who makes the idol? So who's the real God of people who make idols and worship them in their mind? Ultimately, I am. But I'm looking for something beyond me because I know I can't do it all. So I make these things called gods, and we have all different kinds. Most of us don't whittle our gods today and put them on the mantle, but we have our own versions of gods today that we create and we worship. But we create them because we know we need something besides us and we've rejected him. And so we're trying to create something that will somehow come through for us. And it won't work. It won't work. When we reject God, it's one of the loneliest experiences in all the world. I'm alone. I've rejected my Creator. I'm alone. It ultimately leads to me assuming that role of being the ultimate in my life. And it ultimately leads to me creating other kinds of gods, but I'm in charge. I'm the real power behind those gods, but I need some help. And so I go through this crazy ritual of building or making other gods, even if it's just in my own mind, so they can help me out because I know I need some help. Because I've rejected him. That says something about me. I've used this illustration in class here before. You may think that the only thing I ever do is watch the movie Rudy. But I like that little movie. And there's one place in there that I think just captures this, the essence of some of this in a powerful way that I've shared before. But for those who haven't heard it and for those who have, I will share it again. Rudy is this young guy who wants to play football for Notre Dame. But as one of his trainers tells him, he's 5 foot nothing and he has zero talent. On top of that, he has no grades to get into Notre Dame to play football, to even be a part of the school, let alone play on the football team. But he's determined, and he ends up going to a junior college right next to Notre Dame. Every semester, at the end of the semester, he applies to Notre Dame. You can only do that the first 4 semesters, the first 2 years. And after that, if you haven't gotten into Notre Dame by the beginning of your junior year, you can't get in those days at least. And true story. And he comes down to that last time, and he's applied his last time, and he doesn't know what's going to happen if he doesn't get in, because he's built his whole life around that. He's given up his job and everything else to come and do this. And everybody's thought he was crazy, and if he doesn't get in, they're just going to know he was crazy. And so he goes into the chapel there at Notre Dame, and one of the priests who had helped him originally comes up and he says, "Rudy, what's the matter?" And he says, I don't know what to do. I've prayed. I've done everything I know how to do. I don't know what is it going to take to get into Notre Dame." And the priest says this. He says, "In all my years of ministry, I've learned 2 incontrovertible facts. Number 1, there is a God. Number 2, I'm not him." Powerful. That is the lesson of life, that where life begins for all of us. There is a God, and it's not me. When I realize who God is, it helps me understand who I am, because I'm really not God. When I take on the role of God, I'm denying him, and I'm denying the benefit of getting to know who I really am. And I'm caught in a trap of having to live a lie. I know that I'm not ultimate. I know that I don't have all power. I know I can't do all things. But I've rejected the one who can. So where does that leave me? It leaves me empty, alone. It leaves me trapped. And a lot of our friends are trapped. They're lonely. They're desperate. They need to learn the lesson of Rudy. And hopefully we can talk about how to do that a little bit. Now then, let's look at the middle there of page 3, concepts of God and their resultant impact on our concepts of man or who I am in all of this. What does that tell me about me? What can I learn about me? So we're going to look at 10 different concepts that people have of God. Basically, every one of your friends and relatives has one of these concepts or a blending of them, including us in this room. There are none of us who have a pure, an unadulterated, undiluted view of God. But the first one there is atheism, and there beside it, you see the in parentheses, 20%. The reason I put that there, in 1900, when there was a worldwide survey done of religious belief, it was the first survey of its kind that had ever been done in 1900, and 0.2%, not 2%, 0.2 of 1%, 0.2% of the world claimed to be atheist in 1900. It's not on your notes? Okay, it should be. Put 20% there. Next to atheism. Next to atheism. Okay? In 1980, they did the exact same survey. And what they found in 1980 is that 20% of the world's population claimed to be atheist. In the 20th century, atheism was the fastest growing religion in the world. It went from basically nothing to 20% in 80 years. Nothing, another survey like that has not been done since 1980 for me to give you comparative numbers today. But I have a feeling that number didn't go down. If anything, it went up since 1980. If you think about the world we live in now compared to 1980, some of you can't even think back that far, but for others, we can. That the world has changed, and it hasn't been getting closer to God in that period of time. But what is atheism? It says there, atheism is a belief that there is no God. Would you just underline that? There is no God. That's what it believes. There is no God. They would go so far as to, I know there is no God. I know there is no God. Everything in life can be explained and understood apart from any concept of God in their mind. There in your notes, it says in that second line underneath that, I am alone in the universe and I am left to myself to make life work for me. Whatever that takes is okay. Most atheists are of the belief, therefore, that man himself is what is ultimate, the highest power in the universe. There is no morality, only utilitarian choices. Utilitarianism means I just do what works. And in this case, what works for me. If it works, then it's right. And if it works for me, that's what I'm going to choose, that serve me and my self-interest. Jean-Paul Sartre was a famous proponent of atheism. And again, next year, this semester, we'll study more about Jean-Paul Sartre and some of the things he wrote and believed as well. Ultimately, I have to make life work for me if I'm an atheist. If I don't believe God exists, then it's all up to me. I've got to make life work. So what is that? What position does that put me in? I'm in charge. I'm what's ultimate. I'm my own God. What about when somebody disagrees with me? Well, unless their explanation helps me do what I want to do better, I can just reject them. And I say that you're wrong. Let me ask you this. Why do you think we live in a world today where relativism is so prominent, where what you believe is okay for you, but what I believe is okay for me. And we may totally disagree. You may say this cup is black, and I say it's white. And in the world we live in today, we would be able to say, well, you must be right and I'm right. It's just my perspective. Okay? How do we get there? Because I'm in charge and you're in charge. I make the decision, the final decisions. You make the final decisions. So whatever I decide is right for me. We live in a world where this view of God is taking hold more and more in people around us. Even people who are believers are falling into the trap of believing they are ultimate. They give lip service to God, and they will attend services that talk about God, but they live as if they're in charge, because we've been influenced by a world around us that is moving more and more in that direction. There is no God. I know there is no God. By the way, when you read any documents that explain their belief system and everything, you will find that atheism, generally speaking, claims to be a non-religion. But they have a belief system, and when you have a belief system, you're a religion. Okay? And their belief system starts with there is no God. And it goes on from there. But that's where it starts. They will say it's not for us to prove that there is a God. It's for others to prove that there is a God if there is one. Which has been done. But anyway. The second one is agnosticism. Very similar. Agnosticism is another belief view of God that says there you cannot know if there is a God. Doesn't say there isn't one. It just says you cannot know if there is a God. He's unknowable. They would go so far as to say, I know that you cannot know there is a God, which gets real tricky. We'll talk about that in a couple weeks. But it's just this whole idea, God does not exist, can't know if God exists. What's the practical difference between atheism and agnosticism when it comes to how I view myself? Virtually none. When it comes to the impact upon me, if I cannot know if there is a God, therefore it's irrelevant if there is one or not, then I live as if there isn't one. And that puts me back in charge again. Okay? Very little difference there. Both become very utilitarian. Both end up making decisions based upon what works for me to get what I want. And that becomes a determining factor of what's right and wrong, and we'll talk more about that next week. The next one is the mind of man. Some of you are saying, now wait a minute, Rick. I thought we were talking about God. Well, going all the way back to Plato, 300-400 BC, from that time forward, there has been this belief that Plato popularized. He didn't necessarily invent it, but it was a philosophy that he popularized because he was so prolific in his writing compared to other influential philosophers of that day in Greece. But he popularized this idea that there are two eternal realities in life. Everything material is evil, and the mind or thinking or reasoning or logic is what is good. So everything in this room except for our thoughts, our reason, our logic is evil, and it's always going to be that way. Nothing can be done to get rid of it. But it can be curbed if we will work on our mind, which is pure and holy in his way of thinking. It is the one good thing in life. And if we will work on our minds and put our minds together, we can build a better world where evil can be put in its place more and more and more. He even went so far as to say you ought to go around your village and find the brightest young men that you can find. And yes, he was a chauvinist, but go around and find the best young men that you can find and lock them up in a prison, basically, and give them food and water and let them think and let them rule the village. because that's the best way to do it. Put their minds together, let them think, let them reason. So what do you think from Plato's point of view was the best way to help the world ultimately? Educate the mind. The mind's got to be educated. So he wrote prolifically. He wrote about astronomy. He wrote about the body, the human body and the organs, and he studied all of those, and he had his ideas about how all of the organs in a human body function together. He had his ideas about government and how it ought to work, and he wrote about all these things. He studied and interacted with other people and got the best ideas and wrote all of these down in very creative ways to draw people in. He created schools. Even in the time of Christ, there were Platonic schools still going on. The times of Paul, there were schools of philosophy, buildings, schoolhouses of philosophy that would teach these kinds of things, among other things. So they were trying to educate as many people as possible to do that. Now we can say that was a long time ago, Rick. That was Plato. That was 300-400 BC. How many of us who have had children have had the thought in the back of our mind, if I want to give my kids the best advantage in life, I've got to do what? Get them a good education. They got to go to the best schools. They've got to have the best teachers. If I give them a good education, the best education, then they're going to have the best chance of making it in life. Where did that come from? Yeah. Now, some of you are saying, Rick, are you against education? No. Not against education. No. If I was, I wouldn't have gone to school so much. So I'm not against education at all, but it's not the ultimate answer. It's not what is ultimate. But in Plato's mind, and in many people's mind today, in some form or fashion, it is what is ultimate, the mind. Educate the mind. Train the mind. Learn how to think. Gather as much information as you can. And to Plato and to many other people today, the mind is what is ultimate. So therefore, it's God. The next one is human history. Rick, I thought again, we were talking about God. Why are we talking about human history? You'll notice down at the bottom of the little explanation there, the person that I talk about as having popularized this was Karl Marx. Again, he didn't invent this, but he is the one who popularized it and eventually led to the communist revolution in Europe and really in many places all over the world. But he had this belief, and his belief was this, that human history repeats itself. There are cycles in history that keep repeating themselves. Every 20 years, every 40 years, every 100 years, every couple of hundred years, there are certain cycles that repeat themselves. And he wrote about human history as if it was this giant wheel that had fixed things that were going to happen on it that rolls through life with these things repeating themselves. And every time one of those things gets to the ground, it's going to repeat itself over again. And he says, what we need to do is to figure out where that cycle of human history is at and get in tune with it, or it will roll over us and crush us. And he talked about human history. If you read the works of Karl Marx, he wrote about human history and popularized the idea that it was an entity of itself. It wasn't a study in school. It was something that was determinative. It determined what was going to happen next in life, in history, in our society. And we better get in tune with it or else. We can say, well, that was a long time ago, Rick, and people today don't believe that. Did you see a little movie a few years ago? It's a little passe now, but The Lion King. Remember how it started, what the theme song was? Circle, yeah, there you go. We got someone that can sing it. But it has to do with the circles of life, that it just keeps going on and on and on. A variation of this, but it comes back to this kind of a thing. It's determinative. It's going to determine things. Not God, not me. But this thing called human history is just rolling along, and it's going to determine what comes next, because everything repeats itself in a certain order. Then we come, by the way, what does that say about me? I just mentioned it briefly. I'm insignificant. I'm not important. I don't determine anything. He doesn't determine anything. There's something else that determines all these things. All I do is choose if I'm going to get on board or not. I choose if I'm going to be smart or I'm not going to be smart. If I'm going to get in tune with things or if I'm going to get crushed. I just choose. But that's the only choice I have. Then we talk about science. Science is ultimate in this view. I mentioned Sigmund Freud. We could talk about a number of other people as well, going back even further than Sigmund Freud. But really, from the time of Sigmund Freud on, it has grown in popularity. And some of you are saying, Rick, you're against history, you're against the mind and education, you're against science. I'm not against any of those things. I was a history major in college, for goodness sakes. I appreciate history. And when it comes to science, I love science. I really do. But it's not ultimate. It's not ultimate. But there are those who believe that it is. If I can't see it, taste it, touch it, or prove it, then it can't exist. You've got to show me. You've got to give me evidence. You've got to prove to me that this is real using the scientific method. But some would say if it can't be proven by science, it can't be true by the scientific method. And again, when we look at that, we start limiting our views on life, because we can only believe what science can prove. But science itself, it has admitted that there are some things that cannot be explained by science. So what do I do with that? What do I do? How do I move forward with that if I can only believe what I can see, taste, touch, hear, smell, what my senses can grapple with? If that's all I can believe, then what about electricity? Because to this day, we're still grappling, trying to figure out how it really works. Now, we can explain certain functions and what happens, cause and effect. When I do this, this happens. But what makes that happen? Where does that initial spark come from? How does that happen exactly? And we still grapple a little bit trying to explain that, and yet we all use it. We're sitting in a lighted room hearing me speak on a microphone that probably none of us in this room very well could explain how all that happens, the science of it. And yet we believe it. Why? We experience it. We get to enjoy it. You hear my sound better now versus when we don't have the microphone. You see better when there are lights on than when you don't have them on, etc. What that says about me is, when it comes down to science, virtually most people who put science as God would say, I'm nothing more than just another animal, and I live on basic instinct, and I need to do what makes me feel good, and if I feel like doing something, I ought to do it. I ought to just live by instinct, and that sort of thing. So if you have friends or family that says, if it feels good, do it, there's a certain degree of this view of life that they probably have. There could be some other variations of other things as well, but this might be one of the things that they're looking at. The environment is the next one, the fifth one that we want to look at just briefly here. The environment. This was popularized by B.F. Skinner. He was a psychoanalyst at Harvard University, wrote prolifically back in the early 1900s, middle 1900s. Popularized, if you've ever heard of behavior modification and those kind of things, all of those came out of B.F. Skinner a long time ago, and he wrote a book called Beyond Dignity and Worth. He was making a statement. He was saying that it's our environment that determines who we are. Our environment is what is ultimate. If you're born in America, you're going to be a Christian. If you're born in some other part of the world, you're going to be a Buddhist. If you're born in another part of the world, you're going to be a Muslim. If you're raised in this kind of a family, you're going to turn out this way. If you're raised in another kind of a family, you're going to turn out a different way. Everything is determined by our environment, he would teach. I don't know if you were ever in, when you were in school, in junior high, kind of, we'd start doing experiments with, I don't even know if they allow you to do that anymore because it's cruelty to animals, but I remember building this maze in my house for a science project, and I had a mouse in there, and I had to train the mouse to go get its food here instead of here through electrical shock. And if he got it over here, he got shocked, and if he got over here, he didn't, and I had to keep measurements and do all those things, thanks to B.F. Skinner, because my science teacher was trying to prove to me we are only products of our environment. We are trained to do what we do by our environment, and we're just products of those. So what does that leave me with? I'm just a victim of my environment. I'm just a victim. I have no dignity. I have no worth. I'm just an animal who's a victim of his environment. I have no responsibility. Sound familiar today? I'm not responsible. That's just the way I am, or that's my parents' fault, or whatever. Whenever we do those kind of things, we're saying, no, it's not my fault. I'm not responsible. Somebody else or something else is, because they determine my environment. We live in a world today that has been mesmerized by this thing that the environment is ultimately determinative in our lives. Okay, let's take a shift now. Those first five all have to do, those first five views of God all have to do with, if we ask them, do you believe in God, they would either say no or they would say it. God is not a person in any of those. God either doesn't exist or can't be known to exist in atheism and agnosticism, but when it comes to science, the environment, and the other one, whatever it was, human history, all of those would refer to what is ultimate? Well, it, human history, it, science, it, the environment. Now then, these next views of God all believe that God is a person, these last five. Let's look at them. The first one there is theism. Theism. Roughly 50% of the world's population, maybe a little bit more, but roughly 50% of the world's population claims to be a theist. 33% roughly Christian, and 17% Islamic and Judaistic. Judaism. But 50%+, just a little over 50% probably of the world's population claims to believe this. Theism is the belief that there is a personal God who is beyond this world. He's transcendent. He's beyond it. He's greater than this world. And yet is also involved in this world. He is immanent. He's involved. This would, and if you want to talk about monotheism, there is one God, not many gods, and this would be more properly what I'm looking at here is monotheism. There is one God who is transcendent. He's beyond this world. He's not a part of this world in the sense that he's not made up of rocks and sticks and carpet and all of that. He's greater than this world and beyond it, but he's also involved in this world. That would be some of the basic tenets of that. Given that, he is the creator of all things, ultimately. Therefore, I am a result of his creation. Therefore, who's greater, him or me? Well, he is. He's the creator of the thing. Just like we talked about idols a while ago, what's greater, the one, the idol, or the one who creates the idol? Well, really, the one who made the idol is greater than the one who than the idol itself. We are creations of God, according to monotheism, and therefore we are lesser than him. He is greater than us. We are under him, and because he created this world, he's the one who calls the shots. He is ultimately in charge, puts me in my place. Okay? Now, the next view, by the way, from a biblical point of view, it would go on and say, and even from a Jewish point of view, it would go on and say, and I was created in his image. And that gives me dignity and worth, not because of how great I am, but the one who created me is so great. It gives me dignity. It gives me worth and value because of the creator that I have. He also gave us responsibility, things to do. The next one is deism. Deism. I believe that many, many, many who are attending churches regularly, even some who are actually Christians, are practical deists. Okay? Deism is a belief that there is an almighty God who is beyond this universe. He's transcendent, like we just talked about, just like theism, but he is not involved in the universe. Anyway, you'll notice at the bottom there I put Thomas Jefferson. I'm not trying to belittle Thomas Jefferson in any way, but that was his belief, and he wrote about it. He even created his own Bible, went through the Bible and cut out every miracle in the Bible because that showed some kind of involvement by God in the world. The Thomas Jefferson Bible. I mean, he was pretty blatant about, this is what I believe. He's probably the best known figure in our early history, but there were many who were early on. Most of our Declaration of Independence, our Bill of Rights, have all kinds of deistic language and wording in them that we'll talk about next year. We'll look at that a little bit. But it believes that there is an almighty God, the God who is described as the creator. They believe in that God. They just don't believe he is involved. The best way to describe their point of view, and they would even use this illustration themselves, is that it's like God, the creator, created this clock, and he wound it up, set it on the shelf, and it's on its own. I made the clock, I made it to be able to run, and I wound it up, and now it's running, it's on its own. And where the person is left who is believing in this is that, well, I've got to figure out how God designed life. There's a problem. You can say, well, he gave us a book. Yeah, but that would mean this book is supernatural. And I don't believe God revealed his word to mankind. Prophecy is supernatural. It's God's involvement in the world. Can't go there. This is a nice book of stories, but I can't go there for truth, for absolute truth. But I can go there for wisdom. I can go there for get some ideas maybe about how life works as it compares to what other people have said. But I've got to figure it out, and I've got to make it work in some form or fashion. So where does it put all the responsibility? It puts it on me. It puts all the responsibility back on me. He's there, and I'm ultimately going to be accountable to him, a deist would believe, but it puts all the responsibility back on me. You can say, well, that's awfully, I don't know if I could believe that or not. You know, I look at my life sometimes, and I say, if I really believe God is there, and he hears and responds to prayer, how much do I pray? Or do I live as if it all depends on me? That's why I'm saying many who of us who claim to be Christians and some who are live as if he's not involved in this world and it's all up to me. We live like we're deists, even though we may believe in our head something different. The next one is pantheism. Pantheism. Notice that I put down there underneath the explanation, George Lucas, the author of Star Wars. Somebody's saying, Rick, you don't like anything. You don't like history. You don't like science. You don't like Star Wars. Actually, I love Star Wars. But George Lucas, in a Time magazine article, made it clear. He was interviewed after the first Star Wars movie came out years ago. He was interviewed and asked, where did you come up with the idea and why did you do this? And he said, when I was, 12 or 13 years old, I had this experience and I became a Buddhist. And I want the young people of America to know that Buddhism is really not that weird of a thing. That's why he wrote it. He is a pantheist. And quite frankly, in the world we live in today, and here in California, we are chocked full of pantheists. People who believe these kinds of things. Pantheism is the belief that there is no personal God, but rather God is everything and everything is God. Think about the whole nature movement. We talk about Mother Nature as if she is determinative. And we may joke about that and laugh about that, but there are a lot of people who aren't. Pantheism and naturalism or naturism are going closer and closer together and joining forces today. There is no personal God. Well, what is ultimate then? Well, the world we live in is what is ultimate. And you put it all together and it has a force. The force comes from everything in this world coming together and functioning. Well, how do you explain bad things? Well, there's a dark side of the force, and there's a good side of the force. And we hear a lot of that today. Pantheism does not believe technically in good and bad or good and evil. They just believe there is a dark side to things. I don't understand that. It's a dark side that does bad things, but it's not evil. So somehow I'm not sure I get it all, but pantheism is this belief that God is everything and everything is God. The chair you're sitting on is a bit of God. You are a bit of God. But it's the collective world that we live in that makes the greater God, and the sum of all the things that make up this world forms a greater force than all the individual pieces. When they're all put together, it creates this force that is God. And we better not mess with that force in any way whatsoever. So I am someone who needs to get, when it looks at me then, if I believe in all of this, then I need to get in touch with the world I live in. I need to be a functioning part of it. I need to protect nature, because that's a part of the world. I need to protect the smallest whatever it is and take care of it, because that is part of what makes up God. And every time we kill something or something dies or something is burned up or abused in some way, God gets the force gets a little weaker. And we got to do everything we can to make God as great as it can be, in some form or fashion. And therefore, we will be better off if we do that. Polytheism, the next one, since I'm running out of time here. Polytheism, simply the belief that there are many gods, different from monotheism. But there are many gods. So if I... And typically when we believe in many gods, the American Indians would be here in our part of the world would be typical of that in more modern days. But if I need more sun for my crops, I pray to the sun god. If I need more rain, I pray to the rain god. If I want a baby and I haven't been able to have one, I need to pray to the fertility god. Or if our crops aren't really going to make it, maybe I pray to the fertility god to make the crops fertile and grow and produce great and all of that. And I pray to these gods that they would do certain things. But all they are elements in the world. that are beyond my ability to understand, and I give them power that God didn't create them to have. And when you read the Old Testament, you read God being the only God in the midst of a world that believed in these polytheistic gods. And you see God putting them to the test and showing they are impotent and he is all-powerful. And all the way through the Old Testament, you will see God showing the people that the gods that they're worshiping are only creations of the one God that he made, that in and of themselves have no power to change their lives. Finite Godism, the last one we have here. Finite Godism is a belief that God is beyond and involved in the universe. So it believes there is a God who is the creator. He's involved in this universe as well, just like monotheism does. But he is not in ultimate control of it. I call this the struggling hero view of God. God's the one who created everything, but it sort of got out of hand. It's grown so big and so great, he can't keep up with it all now. He's sort of like Superman. He's great and powerful, and he can do supernatural things, but he just can't be every place all at the same time. So when a tsunami's happening someplace else in the world, and I'm having a struggle that I need some help, well, he didn't have time for me because he's over there. Make sense? He's too busy with other things that are more important than my little problem that I'm having by comparison. And that's the view of God that we have. By the way, an area of theology today that is has been growing rapidly and is highly taught is called open theism. And it's very much this kind of a view of God, and it's very strong. You will go, I guarantee you cannot go into a Christian bookstore today without finding books that have been influenced by this open theism, which is basically finite Godism. It basically says God is still trying to figure it out. God's doing the best he can, but it's gotten too big for him. He's trying to figure it out. He's trying to work it through. He's not ultimately in charge. I believe that the majority of people who attend churches in the United States today are deists and finite goddess in reality. They believe there is a God and he is powerful, but some of them believe he's not involved, or he would like to be, but he just can't be. And we live that way. And that is not what the Bible teaches about God. All of these views except for monotheism, leave us with one thing to call upon, or a few things. We can either say, well, there is no God, or I can't know if there's a God, therefore I'm in charge. Or we can say, there are forces at work that are beyond me, and I'm just a pawn. I'm just a victim. Or we can say, there's a God of some sort, but it really falls back on my shoulders to make everything happen. I've got to make, if I don't do it, nobody else will. I've got to make life work for me. And quite frankly, when you study the history of the settlement of America, you study about the rugged individualism that settled the West in America. And that rugged individualism was saying, it's all up to me. I will make it happen. And we have a lot of that heritage in our country today. It's all up to me. I'll make it happen. Even by people who say there is a God who is beyond this world, who is the creator. Even if they say he is involved in this world, they will say, but he just doesn't seem to get around to me when I need it. So I've got to take things into my own hands and make it work. Can you see how complex it can get, how convoluted it can get? But people have all these different views of God. And what we're going to try to do as we go through this semester is keep coming back to some of these things. So hopefully by the end of the semester, they make a little bit more sense. And you're thinking right along with me. You're saying, oh, I see that. And that's where we're going to go. Now, if you'll look on page 7 of your notes there in wrapping up. This is where we're going this week and next week, these concepts of God and man. Now, on your chart there, you'll notice there's a line between the concepts of God and the concepts of man. Here's what I'd like you to do. Would you make that line into a double arrow? It's pointing up and it's pointing down. Because the reality is, sometimes my view of myself and mankind has an impact upon what I believe about God. Most of the time, it works the other way, where my concept of God has an impact upon what I believe about myself. Let me give you an illustration. Let's imagine that I'm raised in a home, and I hear all kinds of things about God growing up. My parents take me to church. They are believers. They take me to church. They do all these things. And I keep hearing these things about God that are fairly accurate things that I hear about God. And I go through high school and I go off to college. And all of a sudden I have a professor or two or three or ten that start telling me different things about God. And then I have to wrestle with the way I grew up. Is that right, or is this right, or is it some kind of a combination of these things? And we often, when we get into those situations, we'll find students who are wrestling with, well, who is God? That's not what I'm hearing. I became a Christian the weekend before I started college in terms of really understanding the gospel and responding to it the weekend before. I'd been raised in a Christian home, and I had been taught a lot of good things, good Christian beliefs and everything, but I clearly remember understanding the gospel and responding to it clearly that weekend before I started college. I was a pre-med major. I had a chemistry teacher who told me in chemistry class that everything came from these little creatures that came out of the primordial ooze. There was no God to explain how we all got here and everything else. And he began to talk about all those different things. Now, I'd had been taught evolution since the time I was in seventh grade. I had that every year over and over and over again. Wasn't anything new. I had a biology teacher who, by the way, the chemistry teacher and the biology teacher were friends, but not best friends by any means. But the biology teacher, he said, you know what? The more I study the human body and the more I study plant life, the more I'm convinced that there's got to be something beyond just evolution to explain where all this came from. And he says, and I can't get away from that. And he would talk about that all the way through. And I went through that first year of college with these two profs, back-to-back classes, teaching me different things. In my mind, I'm having to decide, what do I believe is true? What is right? And when I would wrestle, when I'd lean toward one direction, it started making me feel a certain way. When I'd lean toward the other direction, it made me feel a different way about who I am. The more I leaned toward the biology professor, the more I realized there's a God who's greater than me. And therefore, it says something about me. When I listened to the chemistry teacher and I heard him teaching there, the things that he taught, and I started believing some of those kind of things more and more, it made me feel like I'm just an animal. I'm no different than a dog. I just can think better. That's all I am. And it gave me a certain sense of power, but emptiness. A certain feeling of power. Well, I'm in charge. I can do whatever I want to do. I can do whatever I feel like doing. But the more I thought that way, the emptier and more futile it all felt. I found myself going back and forth, and by the end of that year, I realized the biology professor was teaching something that really fit with life, and I began to make some serious choices in life and began to do my own study on things that has continued on to this day. Who is there really a God, and what is he like? And the more I study him, the more I realize he is great and awesome, and I am not, except by his design and his will to make me whoever I am and to use me however he wants to use me. It makes a difference. If I come into this world and I think I'm the greatest thing since sliced bread, and there's nothing greater than me, and I'm not responsible to anything or to anyone, how in the world can I believe in an almighty God? How can I get there? See, something's got to happen in me. It's called being humbled, being brought to my knees. And God will do things to show me over and over and over again, I'm not as almighty as I think I am. I'm not as in charge as I think I am. I'm not as in control as I think I am. He will allow natural disasters that I have no control over. He will allow death in the family that I have no control over. He will allow all kinds of things, and he will work on who I think I am so that he can make room for who he is in my life. And God is doing that with some of your friends, some of your family members, some of you, some of us this right now. He's working on us to shape the concept of man, who I am, so that it opens room for who he truly is. Next week, we're going to see that that combination of the views I have of God and myself spill out into my ethics on the chart there, my ethics, my values, and my view of time and timing, which are the three factors that go into making decisions. What's right and wrong? What's most valuable? And how do I view time? Is this all there is? Is there more than this? How I view that will come out of those concepts of God and man and who determines what's right and wrong, what's most valuable, and how I look at time that I have. Okay? Let me pray. And again, next week, if you're going to get this book and if you can get it in time, I'm glad you asked. The first couple chapters, it's 9 or 10 pages. That would be great. If you can't get it by then and you want to get it, just order it and catch up when you can. Again, you're not missing, there's not a whole lot of reading for this week. At the very end of the tab one that you have there for this week, there is an article called Relating to Your World. I would encourage you to read that for next week. Whether you get the book or not, I'd encourage you to read that. It'll add illustrations to what I've just talked about tonight and what we'll talk about next week. Any questions at all? Okay, let's pray. Father, thank you again. God, I pray that you would help us to be able to think this semester, think outside the boxes that we all have created in our minds, to think about other people and where they're at in life, where they're coming from. I pray that you would put friends and family members on our hearts as we go through this semester to say, oh yeah, I've heard those words out of their mouth. I've seen those choices that they've made. And give us a heart to know more about them, to ask them questions that are gracious, that are gentle, that are caring, respectful, gracious. Move into their lives, get to know them better. God, I pray again you'd use this this semester in a powerful way in our lives. In Jesus' name, amen. Now, what we will do, we went a little longer than usual in the teaching tonight, but what we will normally do at this point is have some discussion questions around at your table for you to discuss about what we talked about. But tonight, what we would like to do is just give you the opportunity, if you would like to be part of a group. I know there was somebody who said they were here as a young couple, and if some other couples wanted to join them, where are you at? Right here? If you would like to be a group with them, or if you'd like to get with some other people. Otherwise, we're just going to have it at your table. So come in and sit with the people you want to sit with, or get to know the people you sit with, and afterwards you'll have a little bit of a discussion about what we talked about and have a chance to engage a little bit about that material. Okay? These first 2 weeks, we're not getting a whole lot into the Bible. We did a little bit tonight at the beginning, but after tonight, you will find that we will, every week, every one of the 12 questions, we'll start with, how does the Bible answer that question? And what are passages that do it? And then we'll go from there. Okay? Enjoy your getting to know each other around your tables if you want to do that right now. Or we will see you next week at 6:15.